I'm sitting with Gary Levinson, who is the Artistic Director of the Chamber Music Society of Fort Worth and the Senior Principal Associate Concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra since 2002. You still play the Stradivarius violin that's on loan, correct?
I do.
Okay. He's had very many great teachers, including Dorothy DeLay. This is where I'm going to fail a little bit, because I read these names.
Confidence.
I've never pronounced them. Glenn Dictrow?
Perfect.
Oh, excellent. And Felix Gallimir.
Perfect.
But what I did not know about Mr. Levinson before coming here was that he was actually not born in the States. He was born in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right.
I would have never have known until I read the biography and did my research. He studied at the Leningrad Special Music School with Professor Sergeyev. And immigrated to the U.S. in 1977. I guess that's where I want to start. What was life growing up in a musical family, Russia during those years?
I think actually, I have to say it was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
I came here at the age of 10, so you have to take all of this in the context of a kid.
Yes.
And as a kid, I was exposed to some of the greatest musicians on a personal level. I was exposed to great recordings. I went to great concerts all the time. In some ways, I was kind of equate the Soviet system in a way to the Suzuki method, in that there is very little choice. But mm-hmm. unlike the Suzuki method we can discuss in a minute, they kind of don't let you do the wrong thing.
Right.
They just kick you out. So you either do the right thing or you're out. And you can do what you want. So the idea of the technical ability, sound production, how you hold the instrument, playing etude scales, arpeggios, even the pieces, while musically I have major problems with it, from a technical standpoint of view, it's really pretty good. So I would say from the time that I started playing the violin at age 5 until we left the Soviet Union, the equipment that I have on the instrument is pretty good. So I didn't have to make any changes, which is really 90% of it. A lot of the students I get now, I have to make very serious changes to their technique just so they're comfortable playing the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll see that people by a generation, if you will, who studied over there, you can talk about talent, but you really don't have to worry about their training, because it was ubiquitous in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't let you do stuff that wasn't okay.
I have another observation that did not come from me, but from another Eastern European musician who may be one generation younger. He was noting that in the other method you're talking about, the Suzuki method, there are too many pieces in major. When you were growing up, did you have a lot of pieces that were in minor, or that was one of his main complaints about the music?
Too many pieces in major key.
Too many pieces in major.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes kids really want to express themselves in minor, especially when they're 8 to preteen years, through teenage years. They really kind of resonate with that. Was there anything?
I will tell you this, that as a violinist growing up, you have your student concertos, you have your student, and they are almost exactly the same as they are in the West, because if you think of the father of the American violin technique, mm-hmm. Irving Gulamian, was trained by Capet, of course, in France. But, he is the same schooling, if you will, that came from our Stadevsky. Very similar. Bow technique a little different. But, the stuff that you learned as a kid was going to be very similar. So I don't really see that as major or minor. I think, honestly, we just didn't think about it.
Set up
so
and play.
Funny you should mention that, because I remember reading that Mozart piano concertos.
Yes.
In his time, nobody liked the minor ones. The ones that we think are really the most profound.
Right.
Pieces.
Right.
They all like everything in C major. That was really great.
Wasn't that the rub against Prokofiev in like second piano concerto versus the third?
Perhaps. I mean, the rub with Prokofiev in the first violin concerto is that nobody knows it's over because and softly. Whatever. I love playing it. But I don't think of it as a question of keys. I really think of it more as not allowing weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to the Soviet athletic system.
Right.
So, I grew up as a hockey player, so let's just take that as an example. If you were not a good skater but a great stick handler, they would take the stick away from you and make you skate with weights, skate backwards, do everything that you're not comfortable doing,
mm-hmm.
so that you would not be allowed to have these major gaps in your physical equipment. Same thing here. So if you were, you know, I don't know, if you didn't feel comfortable playing double stops,
right,
and you just didn't hear the intonation properly, you would not be doing anything other than that until it got better. Now, looking back on it, I'm not sure I like that sort of draconian approach, but what's behind it, I think, is great.
Right.
And therein lies a very interesting point. Now, there are plenty of teachers, very famous ones, who take the following approach, and that is, make the strength stronger,
mm-hmm.
and let's see what happens with the weaknesses, that we can either hide them or perhaps make them less noticeable. That's where I kind of diverge from that. Now, it may not be a great idea to take a kid, for example, and not let them play anything but scales and arpeggios for 6 years.
Right.
Because they're just going to get very disgusted with the whole experience. But by the same token, I don't think it does them any good to say that, you know, we're going to hide your weaknesses and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one thing that I think we as pedagogues owe the parents and the students is some kind of truth in advertising. So if you can sell them on the idea that, geez, you know, nobody's going to notice it except for the very best. Well, what if you're playing for the very best? Then what?
Right.
You're going to have a disclaimer, my teacher said it was okay? I mean, yeah.
And you're speaking pedagogically, right? Pre-college? I mean, by the time they get to university, do you think it's already, the concrete is settled a little bit, or do you think
I'm
that can still be?
More globally on that. I think okay. We're pedagogues from the start into the finish.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know anybody who practices properly and is not really, at some point, a teacher to themselves. As I say, my better students, like, my job here is to make myself as dispensable as mm-hmm. possible, as quickly as possible. Which is not to say that you shouldn't play for me musically and we'll get good ideas and strength. But you don't want to have a student, whether they're 3 or 300, and be tied to you mm-hmm. so that they can't possibly prepare a piece of music without playing for you 35 times. I mean,
right.
That's my failing. I want to be able to get some kid who goes out there and says, look, I can learn any concerto by myself.
Yeah.
It may not be as great as if I work with you, and that's why we come. But to be tied, to be absolutely addicted to your teacher, I think is equally bad.
There was a great article by Jeremy Dank about his relationship with his teacher in college. He fell in love with him, and he talked about the dangers of that and worshiping the person rather than the message that was coming out.
Yeah, and look, the thing is, like, you mentioned some of my teachers. I really love playing for Glenn. I mean, I love playing for everybody, mm-hmm. you know. But that's very different from being addicted to playing for them.
Yes.
Being addicted to saying that I cannot do it without them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you're using your teacher's therapy as opposed to actual learning.
Correct.
You know, and I don't know if that's so healthy to believe that you can't do it without them and then it's over, you know. It's just not healthy.
Was there any precipitating event that caused you to come to the United States in 77, or is it just a general
It had to do with my parents.
Okay. Well, yes.
I think my parents, look, I mean, my dad was and continues to be a very famous double bass player.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had a very nice position in the Soviet Union, but he also knew that as I started playing the violin and had some talent and some success, you know, the main thing was the education. And the education at the time for Soviet Jews was a real problem.
Okay.
So, you know, my dad...
In particular, Soviet Jews.
Well, that's all we knew.
Okay.
I mean, maybe Bulgarian Jews the same.
Okay, yes,
we
yes,
just
yes.
had no idea. You know, that's all we knew. And so my dad, who did travel the world with the Leningrad Philharmonic, with Mravinsky's great orchestra, he kind of knew that, you know, if I was going to have an equal footing, an equal opportunity, mm-hmm. it was not going to happen in the Soviet Union.
Okay.
So for his decision, along with my mom, was they were going to take a chance, and I emphasize the word chance, because nothing was for sure.
Yes.
To become the enemy of the state and apply. Well, that's exactly what it was. You have to apply for emigration with absolutely no guarantee that you were going to be granted the emigration, but the guarantee that whether you were granted or not, you were already the enemy of the state and were never going to work in the Soviet Union again.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very big thing for me.
And your father's position was not so prestigious that applying wouldn't have immediately resulted in his sacking?
I would disagree. It would not only result in sacking, but mm-hmm. it would also result in the fact that he could never get a job anywhere else, even if he was a school teacher who wanted to drive a bus.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was, and it was very prestigious. He was not a principal player, but he was the third chair.
Mm-hmm.
And he already had 3 solo recordings.
Yes. This is Eugene Levinson.
Yeah.
Okay, just for the record.
I would say... The best way to think about it is the sacrifice of applying was a one-way street.
Yes.
So I guess to them it was better to take a chance at not having the same quality of life mm-hmm. in the Soviet Union, as opposed to not take that chance and knowing that I was not going to get the education to which they felt I was deserved. First teacher was a concertmaster of Minnesota Orchestra named Lee Foley, and my second teacher was a University of Minnesota professor named Young Nam Kim, both of whom were fantastic teachers. And I learned a lot from them, and I owe them an enormous debt of gratitude because of not only what they taught me on the fiddle, but the respect for the music and respect for other musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that doesn't really necessarily take place in the practice room or in the studio. But, you know, I also got a chance to play for people like Sharing and, you know, Nathan Milstein and Stern. You know, it was one of those things that Pinchas Zukerman, I mean, I played for him first when I was 11 years old, and we still have a terrific, you know, personal relationship because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a very important time in my life.
I have to note here that Mr. Levinson did win at least two international violin competitions. One was the Romanini competition, yeah. International violin competition in Italy, and the Jacques Thibault international violin.
Thibault was only a diploma, so we can't really call it winning.
Top prize.
Top prize. Top American, that is. That
yes,
is
top true. American.
Best American in that day.
That is very true. Was there any point, because I'm seeing it a little bit with people that come from Asian countries here, was there a point where you labeled yourself as Russia/USA, or when did you move here and when you attend, you were just USA?
You know, the latter. And I have to tell you that I don't really know if it was a matter of moving here or just personal identity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that by the age of 12, I would say, which is only 2 years post-Soviet Union, I really, and I remember thinking this very clearly to myself, I really identified my musicianship and my playing as American.
Mm.
Absolutely. Now, interestingly enough, then and now, when people listen to me play, they think the approach is quite Russian, the bow arm, stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't disagree. I think it's a matter of pride. But I do hasten to add that the Russian violins playing, much like the piano playing, the Russian school of music, if you will, is very different from the Soviet school.
Okay.
And in my opinion, infinitely superior. And how is that? If you think of the great Russian violinists,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you think of Misha Elman,
yes.
lived in America, Yasha Heifetz, mm-hmm. lived in America, Nathan Milstein, lived in America, Zimbalist,
mm-hmm.
those are the great Russian violinists. Well, who are the great Soviet violinists? Foistrov, mm-hmm. who's my favorite, really has foot in both doors.
Yeah.
But then Tretyakov, Leonid Kogan, and Pavel yeah. the son.
Mm-hmm.
Very different playing. You know, Kagan, what's his name? Oleg Kagan, who played with Richter and some people like that. I don't think they're comparable in quality. I really don't. Very good players. Exception, Gidon Kremer.
Yes.
You know, Philip Hirschhorn.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, incredible talents, and really, if you will, buck the system. But I think these people were really spectacular and not like the rest.
Okay.
Whereas the Russian school of violin playing, very spectacular and very even, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, I can go down the list, I'm just telling you, off the top of my head. But I mean, if we just went down the list, it's just much more consistent. Actually, much more like the Americans now. We have many more.
I was thinking about that as this is during the age of Cliburn and the Levines, and you know, Van Cliburn could almost be called in a way a Russian pianist.
For sure.
Because
that's why he won the hearts of the Soviets.
That's true.
Because to them it was actually a throwback to mm-hmm. before the Soviet era, to Anton Rubinstein.
Yes.
You know, this is the guy you want to hear, and that's why, you know, you look at the videos. I mean, they were throwing flowers at him round one.
Yeah.
It was forbidden to even clap, really. I mean, they went crazy.
It's amazing to think that happened, what?
1958.
Yeah, so that was... and also, however many years, like less than a decade from Stalin at that point?
Stalin died in 1953, so
yes, exactly.
five years out, yeah.
Khrushchev was still, but
you know, he did the right thing. I'm sure you saw the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
He did the right thing because when Gilels went to him and said, "Look, what can I do?" He said,
yeah,
if he's the best, you go to him.
Yeah,
it's the first Tchaikovsky competition.
Yeah, very big admission. Indeed. I think it was a great event for, you know, the relations between the countries.
In my opinion, besides the Bay of Pigs, which was not great, but important, probably the most important social event of the Cold War mm-hmm. by far. Still, the only musician to have ever gotten the ticker tape parade.
Yes,
on Broadway.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever had one since or before.
And he was a really great ambassador, being somebody who's a local product myself of the North Texas area and Texas in general, an American, Van Cliburn was just known as the...
I would say he definitely put Texas on the classical map.
For sure, yes. So, Gary, you wear lots and lots of hats. Obviously, you're a great teacher. You have administrative roles as the artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Fort Worth. You are also a performer with the Chamber Music Society, as well as Blue Candlelight, as well as Dallas Symphony.
Right.
How did you keep all the things you do at a very high level? Was there some sort of breaking in period to all these different jobs, or was administrative and sort of artistic directing a natural outreach of your purely musical pursuits, as in just learning and performing pieces?
I would say it was very natural. We should go back to my New York years, mm-hmm. in that, you know, I had worked for 14 years at New York Philharmonic.
Okay.
And when I was in New York Philharmonic, you know, I was always playing chamber music, and, you know, I got the job with Zubin Mehta, whose first thing,
yes.
besides congratulations, was that I really don't want, this is him talking, I really don't want to stand in a way of anything that you do as a soloist.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was very sweet, and I continued to play a lot more, you know, not a lot more, but I mean certainly as much as I did at Juilliard. And then a few years into my tenure as a section player in New York Phil, there was an opportunity to run a chamber music series across the street.
Okay.
Which was at a violin shop, if you will, a string mm-hmm. dealership of Dietmar Mackold. And it was an incredible opportunity for all of us for three reasons. Number one, one of the stipulations was we had to play these multi-million dollar instruments.
Oh, no.
I mean, not outside, but for these concerts.
Yes.
Which meant that, you know, I not only learned how to play incredible instruments, but I had the ability to have my colleagues play those instruments as well.
I'm sure it was a great draw.
So it was not only a great draw, but it was also, I mean, who wouldn't want to do something like that?
Yes.
And then the fact that it was all paid for by Mackold,
mm-hmm.
and that we could rehearse as much as we wanted to in an acoustically wonderful space. So, you know, my job as AD really was only to, you know, hire the people with their money, you know, and pick smart programs. And that's where I cut my teeth to figure out programming. Because some of the concerts were only an hour long, some mm-hmm. of the concerts were full concerts with intermission. And what I learned very quickly was, you know, how do I not just do it as something I want to play,
yeah.
or my colleagues want to play, but how do I do it to kind of have my butt in the seats? How would it sound like if you played all these really great pieces and that had nothing to do with each other? So, you know, I kind of learned the philosophy of the concert kind of as a novel,
mm-hmm.
where there's an opening, a middle, mm-hmm. and an end. And so now I think it's almost second nature, but in those days I really had to learn the repertoire and really figure out what is it like to listen to this kind of performance.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like to feature a certain piece of music? What is it like to feature maybe certain instruments? So if you're going to play a two cello quintet, what are you going to put around it? You know, do you really want to have an all Brahms program, even though we love Brahms,
exactly.
and so on and so on and so on. So that's where it all started. And then administratively speaking, when you talk about budgets and, you know, board meetings and things like that, I mean, it's just because I've been around. So the idea of the budgets and just working on the business end of it is just because, for whatever reason, after that experience as AD of a music series where I really didn't have to do anything else, then I was working at a music series in Long Island where it was exactly the opposite. They did some of the fundraising, but I mean, a lot of it, I had to meet donors, mm-hmm. I had to make it work. I had to travel a long ways because from Manhattan to Long Island with traffic sometimes an hour and a half.
Right.
And then, you know, had to work with concert halls,
mm-hmm.
had to figure out stagehands, had to figure out a college schedule and work around that. I mean, it was from A to Z. So when I arrived in North Texas, not thinking about anything to do with, you know, chamber music series or running anything, I was pretty much equipped to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And then so when they were interviewing me for Chamber Society of Fort Worth, you know, what I had to do was just kind of show them some kind of vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And I think they liked it. And so then I got the job and we've been very successful because that vision, we're constantly working, not just me, but at the board as well, at making that vision very clear to the audience. So that if you come for one concert or you subscribe or you just look at the website, it should be very clear what we're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why we have names for the concerts.
Yes.
That's one of the reasons why we have all the program notes as early as possible. We do the pre-concert talk. We do the educational programming. All of it's tied in so that, you know, unless you're really not paying attention, you know, it should be pretty obvious what this is about.
Reading the website, I really appreciated the season notes as well as the individual program notes.
Right. That are so relevant. We're trying to make the season notes is kind of a summary, but also gives you something different.
Yes.
That the pre-concert docs, you know, which are also with musical examples and a PowerPoint presentation, that gives you an elucidation that's much different than program notes. So the experience for talking about what we're talking about. What is your experience when you're just listening? Because I love going to concerts.
Yeah.
My biggest problem is I never go. I'm too busy playing. So you know, at Miami Music Festival, where I'm director of strings, you know, I went to Marriage of Figaro. It was fantastic for me as a listener because I could actually enjoy it from row Y and listen to the whole thing, a piece of music I know intimately, but I've always had to play it. And this, you know, I can listen to the singers, I can enjoy the costumes, I can enjoy all of this. So it was, you know, it's a great thing to be able to be an administrator, but also everybody knows I'm a violinist first.
Yes.
And, you know, when I put programming together, it's for us as musicians as well as for the audiences. So, you know, the main thing with the chamber music series is to be clear about what you're trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. and obviously to have the best players and the best performers.
I went to this concert, I think it was last fall. Franklin Cohen came in.
Oh, yeah.
And one of my friends, Jihei, was playing the piano for that concert.
She's coming back in September.
She is. She's an amazing pianist. And it was a very illuminating program, original programming, and just wonderful playing.
That's pretty cool pieces, huh?
Really cool.
Yeah, I'm actually very glad that you mentioned that because that's one of the things, you know, the common knowledge thinking is that, well, because chamber music is for old people, mm-hmm. therefore they're not going to like, you know, somebody as thorny as Hindemith. And I know those pieces pretty well. And also, you know, that was an example of people who are experts at that piece.
Yes.
Like Richard Young, like
Jesus. Yes.
So it was really great for me to be able to get them together and, you know, to program that because we took a lot of time marketing those pieces. I mean, Max Bruch is not necessarily what people turn to when they think about composers.
Right.
And yet, interesting aside is that I was just in Munich 2 or 3 months ago and I was rehearsing in the Max Bruch Academy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, because in Munich, he's their foreign son.
And he was very popular for a while, yes? Oh, during his lifetime, at least,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Well, I think he's popular now. I mean, obviously, everybody knows the violin concerto, but he also has a terrific septet, the pieces mm-hmm. that you're mm-hmm. alluding to. I mean, there are enormously satisfying works of Max Bruch. It's just that his output is not that great. And I don't know that much about his orchestral music.
Right.
But I also know that some of the chamber music with voice is great. So.
Would you consider him an underrated composer?
Totally.
Mm. The most underrated composer or one of the...
That's not fair.
Yeah. I'm kind of leading into one of my questions I ask everybody.
Like, yeah. Maybe define to you what underrated is.
Underrated is not necessarily that they have to be in the pantheon of greatest composers, but rather that their music is not given their due.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be a great master Bach, Beethoven.
Right.
But...
I think when it comes to underrated composers, I think the so-called specialists are often underrated.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. I'm a violinist. Nobody wants to program Vinyavsky concertos or any of Vinyavsky pieces. But if you actually take the score and look at the way it's written,
mm-hmm.
it's incredibly skillful from both the solo and the orchestra. Now, one may say that it's not the richest orchestration, but it's certainly not in the way Chopin orchestrated with Schumann.
I was about to say Chopin as...
Yeah, well, they were both Polish.
Right.
So they knew each other. But, I mean, the bottom line is that if you compared orchestration of Vinyavsky to orchestration of Chopin, there's no comparison.
Right.
And Vinyavsky was much more skilled.
Yes, yes. Chopin wrote those when he was 20 or 19 or some
right.
young age as well.
I
and...
think he was just not so interested.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Schumann is another example. You know, obviously wrote many symphonies, and we play them all.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact from my Philharmonic days that no lesser composer than Gustav Mahler went out and changed a lot of his woodwind writing just
yes.
because it cancels everything else.
Yeah.
So, you know, did Mahler have better things to do? Most likely. But he thought music was interesting enough to take care of it. So I think those are two good. I mean, Izai for me is another one that's totally underrated because
yes.
his language, the Franco-Belgian school, is maybe not something that you know, certain artistic administrators are comfortable with, but his orchestration is very strong. He had the string quartet. His solo sonatas, obviously, repertoire.
Yes.
And his concert pieces are phenomenal.
What would you recommend somebody listen to that's not the violin solo sonatas? Because those are the only things I know, actually, of his
right.
output.
Well, there's a piece for two violins and an orchestra called M.A.T.A. that I play quite a bit because it was introduced to me by my friend Andres Cardenas.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And Gingold as well. I mean, there are quite a few solo and piano, which is really solo and orchestra pieces.
Right.
Poem of Ecstasy is another one. There's some phenomenal works. Honestly, the best way for me to answer it is go and look at anything that he wrote, because I have yet to hear a piece of music of his that's truly boring or not well written.
Yeah. I can imagine, because only knowing his violin sonatas, you see innovation in the way he treats thematic material as well as how well he wrote for the instrument. And you can't imagine that he would write any less well for other string instruments, much less the orchestra.
Yeah, well, he also, we got to remember the context. You know, the Franck's violin sonata, mm-hmm. it was written for him.
Yes.
It was written for Zai, it was a birthday present. So, you know, it was one of those things where we want to sit down and ask ourselves, well, how much did he learn from Franck? How much did he learn from Chausson?
Mm-hmm.
Chausson poem,
yes.
written for Izai, but he actually commissioned a violin concerto. Chausson says, no, not ready.
Yeah.
How about a concert piece? The language of these people definitely rubbed off on Izai's composing, mm-hmm. without any question. And so I think that he's a fascinating composer to go check out for not violinists, you know, for harp players, for God's sakes, because it's one of those things where you, first of all, it opens your eyes. Second, you listen to the other pieces completely differently. Vuitton is another one. I mean, of course he wrote the violin concertos, and you know, the great fifth violin concerto, you know, is after an opera that nobody's ever heard of called mm-hmm. the Grieg Tree. So, I mean, it's one of those things where you are a much more educated musician if you listen to it not as a violin piece, but as a piece of music, because they're all self-contained, they're all freestanding. They're the kind of works that you can really just, you know, throw it in the CD player and really enjoy.
I also think that sometimes when a piece gets assigned for advanced students and you get to hear them with pianos so often, that sometimes the ideas don't seem as original as they really are.
Right. Well, and therein we get into the idea of transcriptions. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the son of a bass player.
Yes.
So I grew up with transcriptions. I happen to like transcriptions a lot. But I mean, the first one to say that, you look, you know, if you listen to Carmen Fantasy, you know, that we all learned.
Yes.
The Sarasate, of course. You know, that's not, it would be insane to say that that's how the opera goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just themes from the opera.
Yes.
So, you know, then you go and listen to Carmen and you say, ah, well, I see what he means.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just one of those things where I think that anytime you can go to the well, to the original,
yes.
you go there.
Are there any composers that you would find as overrated or held in too high of esteem?
Let me answer it this way. I find it very hypocritical that we, as an industry, find certain composers are not to be touched.
Yes.
Perfect example. No cuts in Mahler, because Mahler's the holy
mm-hmm.
grail.
Mm-hmm.
But any Tchaikovsky symphony cut away. Or violin concerto, for that matter. Now, I take the cuts in the violin concerto. I
yes.
think it's repetitive. But it does. What I don't get is why certain ones are not to be touched, Schubert, and others are.
Schubert could stand to be edited.
You think?
A bit.
Yeah.
I mean that's...
The kind of sonatas?
Yes.
Oh my God, 48 minutes of everything.
Yeah.
You know? So
well, let's go to all keys. Every single key.
So, I don't know if these people are overrated. I will say the approach, I think, is quite unfair. And it's not judged equally.
Yeah, okay.
It's not judged on its actual content and merit.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very happy if we either didn't edit anything at all and said, look, this is what the man wrote, take it or leave it. Or we really approach with the same merit, saying, hey, you know, I think this doesn't really work for the following reasons. That's why we take the cut. And then us, as musicians, we still have the ability to say, no, I don't want to take the cut.
Yeah.
Don't want to do it. But it's there if you want to consider it.
Is there any historical evidence to composers like Schubert having contemporaries who performed their work editing along the way? I know there's the story of Rachmaninoff editing his own Corelli variations as he was performing them, just based off of the number of coughs that were coming in the audience.
Wow.
You know, he said that, well, this time I got through 12 of them because the audience started to get restless after 11. And so I went to the end. I don't know whether these composers, especially Schubert, who he lived in very short life. I think the amount of music time-wise versus the amount of life that he lived was probably the highest ratio.
Oh yeah, well, he wrote all the time because he was basically a songwriter. I
mean, yes,
you know, he was the Billy Joel of his time. So, and I'm dating myself with Billy Joel, but I just think that look, I don't know how to really answer that because,
or even Horowitz with people's music like Rachmaninoff Sonata. You know,
I worry about responding to audiences too much.
Yes,
I worry about that. I think if Rachmaninoff were sitting here, certainly Prokofiev, I guarantee this. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about Prokofiev because that I can speak to. He would basically say, this is what I hear in my mind. This is why I wrote what I wrote. And if the audiences don't like it, I'm not changing the note.
So you would say the...
Mahler said the same thing. Tchaikovsky said the same thing.
The idea of editing would be incumbent upon the performers of that work to...
No, I would say that the editing should take place before publishing. Where it should be initiated by the composer, of course.
Okay.
You know, Brahms, the B major trio.
Yes.
You know, he edited it his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Mom dies, he puts in the middle section of the slow mode. So, I mean, I just don't know that it's about the response of the audience. I think it should be precipitated by the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever impetus is, meaning why is it done, it should be good enough for us.
I heard a recording and I wish I had remembered. This is the thing about what I just remember experiences, but putting names and dates and faces on things is not my strong suit. But I heard one recording of this pianist. I think he was active in the first part of the 20th century. Obviously, there's a recording. But he actually put his own prelude. He was preluding. It was an improvisation before a Chopin nocturne. Like it just kind of seamlessly kind of went into it. And I was...
You're not talking about Schnabel, right?
Not Schnabel. It was.
Did some weird things before.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Exactly. And you wonder if that was something that was his own innovation or if it was something that just happened.
Mm.
You know, more during those days, and people thought of it as performance practice.
Yeah. Well, look. I mean, when you talk about performance practice, you know, I always tell students, you know, what are preludes? You know, certainly for what type of clavier? It's obvious, but. You know, even in the Bach sonatas and partitas and sonatas, oftentimes, you know, if you look at the A minor in some ways, it is a prelude to the fugue.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he actually finishes on a dominant because the fugue resolves. I don't know. I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with it, provided that your performance can stand on its own. The whole idea is that if the music can support the interpretation,
mm-hmm.
it can't be the other way around. And that's another thing. It's like, you know, when you're relearning a piece of music, that's one of the things that Delay taught all of us. You know, she was saying that when you learn a piece of music and you play it with the orchestra or you play it in concert, you really don't know it until like the third time you play it.
Yes.
Because it's the stage experience that teaches you what's working, what's not. You know, that's where you figure your stuff out. So if the music can support your interpretation, then you're in good shape. If you have this preconceived interpretation, whether it's from somebody famous or you just like it that way, you got to be real careful and go back to the score and figure out what you're doing.
Would that be a piece of advice that you would advise all up-and-coming instrumentalists to follow?
One of my most draconian rules with my more advanced students is if you show up to my studio without a score, you can go back and get it.
Yeah,
because I need them to know what's going on around them. You know, even if you're playing a concerto, yes, you may have the most important line in that concerto, but it's only one line.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't know what's going on around you, or, you know, you have the piano score, you don't know who's got which solo and so on and forth in the orchestra, you're not going to be making smart decisions. Another thing I try to tell the students is that, you know, don't sculpt your interpretation from the first video that you found on YouTube.
More and more dangerous these days.
It's very convenient.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm speaking as an audiophile here, but I mean, you know, and I have hundreds of recording CDs and all that stuff. That is in part entertainment,
mm-hmm.
in part research.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be step one.
Yeah.
It cannot be step one. The score is step one.
Right.
You know, you're learning the notes, the rhythms. You're learning what's on paper. And then when you know what you're doing on the instrument, with any luck, you're observing the dynamics, you understand, all the tempo changes, you get all that, you play for your teacher, then go and figure out what the great ones do, and then most importantly, figure out why they do it.
Right.
I get people who come in and they make an 8-bar retard over 3 bars, or worse, they make it over 15 bars.
Right.
And then we have to have a discussion, which is actually a very useful discussion, on why, you have to measure it over X number of bars. With very few exceptions, even the quote-unquote second-rate composers,
yes,
really pretty decent at where they wanted their dynamics and their, tempo changes. Really decent.
They're the ones that live with it.
Well, right. But I'm just saying that a lot of them are also performers, yes, and they would try it at the piano, and they would say, yeah, this is not working, so I better shift it over here.
I've found sometimes examples of many performances and of well-established performers who go against the score in exactly the same way after looking at the source. And it's funny. It's almost like one person hears it and they go, oh, that's great, I'm going to do that. And then after X number of performances of it or listenings of it, you look at the score and it says something very different.
Right.
And it's kind of funny to see how that happens, or this sort of groupthink happens.
Yeah, a lot of my colleagues have really great ideas about that. And that is that, if you know a piece of music, especially if you know it by memory,
mm-hmm,
not going back to the score, stuff melts in your head. You go, like, yeah, I thought this was already there, but it's not. It's just the way I do it.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, that's the discussion of, what happens when you play a concerto for the 50th time or the 100th time, or you play the same sonata, over and over. People ask me that all the time. I have yet to play a piece of music that I loved 30 years ago that I detest today.
Mm.
Conversely, something that I had to learn brand new and really loved it, and then, by the third performance, I really can't stand it. Because if it's really good then, why would it be any different? I used to think that, if I take the same nuances, right, it'd be boring. Because everybody does it.
Right.
And then I listened to like 20 performances of a very similar interpretation. And if the artist has real merit, has real personality,
mm-hmm,
you cannot hear that artist play the same phrase twice.
Right.
And it sound the same way. It's, yeah, just not possible. Because they do have something of their own to say every time they play. Which is why, I have, 25 recordings of Beethoven's Fifth, and they're all really fun to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I don't know how it goes, and I know exactly what each one does, but to listen to them with different ears as you go through time is really exciting.
There's an inherent logic or argument that builds upon itself,
yeah,
that makes the performance. Absolutely.
It's,
do you keep copies of clean scores, or do you can you look at a score and sort of mentally erase markings that you've done?
I have to tell you, I don't mark things too much.
Okay.
I'm really kind of religious about, I only mark the things that are absolutely necessary, especially in scores, because I don't conduct.
Right.
So I don't have to have it in front of me. When I do a sectional rehearsal or I do something with string orchestra, I study before,
mm-hmm,
but I really don't need to do anything. If I know the work, I know the work. If the cue's over here, I know where it is.
What about student scores?
I get students, you can't see the notes. It's unbelievable. That's just a pet peeve. Look, I don't like it. I like,
right,
clean music. Look, everybody's different. It's like, I have colleagues who say, well, if you can't sing it, therefore you can't play it. Well, I happen to sing a lot of stuff, and I'm an awful singer.
Yes.
I play a lot better than I sing.
I'm not agreeing with you, but I'm agreeing with the concept.
No, but you see what I'm saying. So I completely disagree with the idea that if you can't sing it, therefore you can't play it. I can play it very well, and I can't sing it.
Yeah.
So if you can hear it in your mind, yeah, then you can play it. And what I think is that for me, what works is studying the score without marking it a lot and retaining it in my head. Other people have to write everything down.
I'm trying to pull from one of your colleagues' lessons that it's not so much about the actual pitches or the singing; it's about the intensity behind the breath that,
yeah,
you do that actually creates the intent that you want to recreate with your instrument,
right,
that can actually hit the pitches. Because
exactly.
I have a range of about a tritone, so
yeah,
it's hard to transpose that
exactly,
many times.
And the thing is also is that, maybe you're not comfortable hearing your own voice, but you're very comfortable hearing your instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that we're going to be taking time at training our own voice when in reality we should be training what we hear and how we hear it?
Mm-hmm. Any pieces of advice that you've heard many, many times that you feel that's antithetical to progress, or that's not really something that's useful
I think, you know, a lot of people say things that sound really good.
Yes.
But they don't reconsider whether they actually are good.
I'm trying to...
My favorite is the conductor who says, oh, follow me. I need you to follow the stick, you know? And that is the best way to just lose about 100 people in a third of a second.
Yes.
You know, I don't know anybody who actively tries not to follow the stick, who spends nights and days thinking, well, what's going to happen is the minute I see the stick, what I'm going to do is the opposite. So that's useless advice. The question is, should be, what do we need to do to follow you better?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, things like that. Play with me, you know. What the people say, you know, if you can't hear so-and-so, therefore you play loud, you know. It's just not useful. What's useful is to inspire, and I use that word very carefully, the people around you to get the best out of themselves. You know, imposing something, with few exceptions, doesn't really result in a group playing well together. And that group could be only two people.
Yes.
So, you know, I prefer to work with people, and myself when I work with younger colleagues, to explore it together,
mm-hmm.
to have options on the table that everyone can live with and get the best out of each one of us for the whole to blossom.
Right.
Rather than...
Here's your goal, don't Google
for it. Yeah, I mean, I can tell you some colleagues who've said, you know, I don't need to know too much. Just tell me how my part goes. Don't because, you know, I have other stuff to do. And I'm like, you know, why do you even want to do this? Why don't you just do the other stuff?
On the other hand, too, as somebody who leads, if whether it be a conductor, section leader, person whose job it is to lead one part of a chamber piece, isn't there some sort of responsibility upon that person to, again, have that logic from the music so implanted in their being and the way that they interpret the piece that everybody kind of knows exactly what they're trying to do. And at the moment, their idea becomes everybody's idea.
Well, absolutely. And you were talking about, you know, being convincing, of course. But, you know, the thing that's complicated is how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, there will be people who say, well, you know, my right way is my way. And then... By definition, if this is the right way, then everybody else must be wrong.
Right.
And then other people will kind of go with, well, I want it this way. And they don't feel like it's necessary to be supported either by the score.
Right.
Or even performing tradition, which is important.
Yes.
So I do think that in order to have credibility, you have to have some things that are obvious, that everybody can agree on. You know, you can't be totally subjective, but then also you can't be totally objective about everything. So I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. But I mean, when you speak about inspiring your colleagues and playing well together, I mean, in the end, I do think that you need not have too heavy a hand, mm-hmm. but you also need to be convinced of what you're doing. So to be convincing, you have to be convinced other than didactic and fanatical.
Yes.
You know, once you get into the fanatical stage, well, then it becomes like, you know, people want to just avoid conflict.
Yeah.
And then what happens is a lot of people start playing defensively.
Mm-hmm.
And defensive playing is not what people want to hear.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, audiences are not going to sit down and say, well, that concert was C+ because it was all defensive and everybody hit all the notes. But the truth was, if nobody thinks that way.
Right.
On the other hand, we all know what has happened. So I think that it's really important. Preparation is obviously really important. And knowing the score is really important. But in the end, you know, if you're talking about chamber music, you have to be with the right people. You know, that's another reason why I'm so careful, both for CMFSW, but for everything. But with whom do we play? Because if either the training or the rehearsal technique or just the way people approach a certain group comes from a certain preconceived place,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to be great. And it doesn't matter if you're going to have 30 rehearsals or 2 rehearsals. I mean, I've had people here... You know, we would have 4 rehearsals and we would just be having fun because we could have done it off 1 rehearsal.
Right.
And then sometimes just the opposite. Everybody's on the same page and it's like pulling teeth.
There's some things, I'm playing with more people now, but there is some sort of chemistry that happens between people or a group. I don't know how to state it. Sometimes I know I'm playing with great people and it feels like we were raised differently. Right. Like you sit in a rehearsal and
Look, here's a perfect example. I'm a string player, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if I had a dime for every kid who was a kid or a college, for that matter, oh, I don't play slides. That's like playing, to me, that's like saying I don't play C-sharps.
Yeah.
Why on earth would you not play with slides if it's warranted?
Right.
You know, why on earth would you put a slide where it's unwarranted? You know? So I think a lot of us get trained with certain, what's the word, symptoms.
So yes.
They're playing a symptomatic of a certain school, if you will, or an approach. And then rather than think about what is a symptom and actually make it line up with what you're trying to express, you just play one symptom after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then your performance is a collection of symptoms, for lack of a better term. And, you know, some of the symptoms may be really good.
Right.
And audiences like it. And others don't. And so it is, I just find it to be a little artificial. And I try to be as unartificial as possible, as natural as possible.
I find telltale sign is if somebody's Mozart sounds like somebody's Tchaikovsky, that sounds like somebody's whatever. It's just, that's kind of what they do all the time. And if they were playing the correct prescribed composers, it would sound great. But then you hear it in something else, you go like, oh, that's what they always do.
It's just obtuse, you know? Yeah. And I think that one of the, we were talking about, you know, playing certain works over and over.
Yeah.
I think one of the, well, probably the number one way of making it fresh is not only to study the score and find new things in it, but to never just play symptomatically.
So, right.
You know, we have, I mean, all of next season I'm playing pieces I've played many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And as I restudy them, it's, you know, I always check every single symptom to make sure it's not just because I'm used to doing it that way.
Right.
You know, in fact, I will do the inverse. I just had to coach the Prokofiev Two Violins Sonata that we're doing on the
concert. Oh, yes, concert. Yes.
So I caught myself at recommending something that I've just always done, and I had them do the exact inverse, just to hear it.
Right.
And that's exactly what we're going to do in rehearsals, because I want to make sure that it's not just done by rote.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good way of checking things. Do the opposite, see if it sounds good.
Do the opposite, because, well, it works, and it's one of those things where it's unclear in the score which way you go. You got to try it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't try it, you will have never heard how it goes. So.
I want to bring up, because again, I love talking to people who have done everything, and you definitely are somebody who has done everything. And I want to find out two experiences. You can use any qualifications you want. What was your best gig and what was your worst gig experience? Some people have actually talked about the entire gig itself, whether it be the musical experience or, you know, the pay involved, whatever. It doesn't have to be that. Or some people have talked about one incident that happened that, you know, caused something to go on the rails, off the rails, or one moment that was just especially magical. So this is kind of a loose question. You're the first person I've talked to who I don't know very well personally. So I just wanted to kind of encompass all the possibilities.
You know, I thought about it. It's hard for me to qualify the best gig,
mm-hmm.
just because I like to talk about the most memorable gig.
Perfect.
You know?
Well, and that, hopefully that's on the good side of the ledger.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Yeah, the most memorable performance is actually, we did some chamber music in a small town in Spain. I don't even remember the name of the town because it was a long time ago. But what I remember about it is we played in an amphitheater, and it had a shell that was a freestanding shell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was nice, everything was great, you know, full house. And then they broke down the shell, and I don't remember why, but we came the next morning. Oh, I know why. Yeah, we were supposed to drive to a town in France, and there was something wrong with the car.
Oh.
And I think I forgot my sunglasses in the dressing room, because the dressing room, you get an amphitheater.
Right.
2,000-year-old thing, and more. And so I went to get my sunglasses, and I had my instrument with me. And I was in the middle of this amphitheater, and there was nothing, there was no acoustical shell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy who was driving me was there, and I said, well, just go up, I want to play something. Because I was wondering what it would sound like.
Right.
And so I played some Bach, and he said, you know, it sounds pretty damn good. And I ended up playing, probably for an hour, some solo Bach without
a shell.
No shell, just one man in the center of an open amphitheater, which, by the way, was much bigger originally when the Romans built it, because there was all these invasions and,
right,
you know,
right.
the people destroyed stuff. And I played, and then my colleague played, and I went up there. And the fact of the matter, maybe it's because I'm an audiophile and I love acoustics.
Yeah.
But that is by far my most memorable performance because of the elements involved. That we were in a place where we just had a great concert.
Right.
That was completely torn down from the concert.
Mm-hmm.
And arguably, I had more fun playing in the original torn down stage than with all of the acoustical stuff there.
There's an intimacy, and there's also experience with the environment, you know, that you already have, and maybe the shadows of what happened the night before. Yeah. As well, I mean,
for me though, it was, I think it was more about the history of what took place in that theater.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was not about the music. None of the amphitheaters were built for music,
although right.
they seemed to be great for music and to play. And I had a very nice instrument that I used in New York Philo at the time. To play there and to play Bach with open air,
mm-hmm.
you know, where 1500 people sat the night before, was it was really transcending of the whole thing. And I never forgot about it. And actually, I've never played in that theater since. So that was another thing why it's made it so memorable, because I haven't been back.
I was thinking about, you know, now whenever we're performing, it's usually in a climate-controlled, everything-controlled environment. But it didn't used to always be that case. That people didn't know about acoustics as well as we do today. They don't analyze it down to the thing, but yet somehow they've created environments where those types of things can thrive, you know.
Which brings me to the worst
experience. Oh, awesome.
So, you know, I played a concert in Germany, and I've since played many, many concerts in Germany, but the Germans, God love them, they have this obsession with open windows.
Okay.
Because they have convinced themselves that no matter what the temperature is inside, an open window will necessarily give them the flu or the cold or something disgusting. So we played in a concert hall in, I want to say, late June, where, well, first of all, German concerts, at least in those days, were endless.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, 2.5 hours, 3 hours,
what
4 hours.
What year are we talking?
I want to say like 1994.
3-4 hour concerts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The first half, if memory serves, the first half was a Mozart divertimento, which is already like 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a horn piece, like horn, violin, cello, viola piece. Then we had the two violins, not of Prokofiev. This is the first half only.
Oh my gosh.
And I think a Schulhoff piece that was very short. So easily an hour and 35 minutes for a half.
Oh my
easily.
Gosh.
Second half, Mendelssohn Octet. I want to say one of the big piano trios. I think we had, oh, we definitely had the Weber clarinet quintet.
It seems like one of those concerts. Yes, it seems like one of those concerts that.
and this was a festival. They were all like this.
Oh,
this is not one concert. So why was it the worst experience? The playing was actually quite good, and the audience was fantastic.
Yeah.
But they shut the windows. We started, the temperature was no less than 95 degrees. It's probably at least 90% humidity.
Full concert dress?
Full concert dress.
Oh.
So, I never sweat.
Yes.
My fingers, it was a river on the fingerboard. So, I was like, you know, what's going to happen to intonation? What's going to happen to any kind of nuance?
Right.
So, and then we had to do this for 3 hours. And then we had to do it the next day. And the next day. And so...
Same program or different programs?
No, different programs.
Oh my
different
gosh.
Days. The whole thing was like 5 days in a row. And after the first half, I went... I don't know why it was me. But I went to the artistic director and I said, you know, it's too hot. You got to open the windows. He said, no. So I said, in that case, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to take off our jackets and ties. He said, no. I said, how about this? You know, either windows or jackets and ties... Or we're not going to play. Nobody's going to play.
Wow.
The rest of the concert. So he actually decided no jackets and ties.
Over the
windows and doors, yeah.
Because somebody might catch something from the breeze.
Yeah. So we played soaked.
Oh.
We have pictures where it just looked like we took a shower with instruments. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty rough. I mean, your instruments, did they suffer at all through the course of the thing, or was there more
to
it?
Not bad. The hair on the bow was really flaccid.
Yeah.
Because after all that humidity, just the screw won't tighten
right.
anymore. which made off the string stuff very difficult. But honestly, it was the discomfort and mentally knowing that you're just exhausted from, and it's not going to get any better. We were there for 5 days.
That's pretty extraordinary.
It was unforgettable.
Speaking of, this has been an incredibly illuminating hour. And Gary Levinson, again, you can find him in the Meyerson like I have for basically all of my formative years. You can find him at the Modern Museum of Art in Fort Worth with Chamber Music Society of Fort Worth. That's chambermusicfw.org, correct?
Yep.
At Blue Candlelight Series, bluecandlelight.org.
Yep.
And wherever else you might find him. Thank you so much. This has been incredible.
It's been great. I've enjoyed it.
And hopefully we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much. Until next time, this is Jonathan Tsai signing off. Bye.